The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. You can find information regarding forums, salons, and membership at cityclubofboise.org. The moderator for today's forum is Corey Serber.
This program is being delivered online, so welcome to our attendees. I want to welcome our radio listeners who will be joining us at a later date via Boise State Public Radio on KBSX 91.5 and its affiliates throughout Southern Idaho and Northern Nevada. Today's forum is available for our audience in large part because of our City Club partners and sponsors. I would like to take time to thank a few of these organizations that help us achieve our mission to ensure compelling conversations, engaged citizens, and a dynamic community. Our premier sponsor is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU College of Business. Our annual sponsor is St. Luke's Health System. Today's program is sponsored by the Ada County Medical Society. We also receive support from our forum series sponsors, AARP Idaho, Bank of Idaho, Climatech Corporation, Echelon Group, Micron, Pacific Source Health Plans, and Small Mind Development. City Club of Boise receives grant funding from the Idaho Humanities Council. Thanks also to our media partners, which include Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, Idaho Statesman, and Idaho Public Television, and our university partners, U of I, BSU, and NNU. Many thanks to those of you who support City Club of Boise with membership or a donation during registration. Following our panelists' open remarks today, there will be an opportunity for them to respond to audience questions. You can use the Q&A function of Zoom. Just type your question in, or you can email it to morgan@cityclubofboise.org, and it will be provided to me. I'll do my best to present as many questions as possible from the audience and may group similar questions together in the essence of time. At this point, I'd like to introduce today's panelists. We're very grateful to have with us today Patrice Burgess, MD, Regional Chief Medical Informatics Officer for St. Alphonsus and a member of the Governor's Coronavirus Testing Task Force. We have Christine Hahn, MD, State Epidemiologist from the Idaho Department of Health and Welfare. We have Ada County Commissioner Diana Lacciando, who is also a board member for Central District Health. And we have James Souza, MD, Chief Medical Officer for St. Luke's Health System, who also serves on the Governor's Coronavirus Testing Task Force as co-chair. So now we'll begin some preliminary questions for our panelists and give each of them an opportunity to kind of field some questions. This forum serves as a bit of a follow-up to a COVID expert forum that we held in June. And I'm just wondering, Dr. Hahn, if you would be willing to give us an update from an epidemiological standpoint. What's the snapshot look like now as far as how Idaho is doing with our trends for COVID cases, deaths, our test positivity rates, and hotspots around the state?
Yeah, so, well, since we last talked in June, of course, a lot's happened. You know, essentially, we had a very large second wave of illness throughout the state that we're just recovering from. So the good news for now is that through most parts of the state, we are seeing declines in cases, in the number of cases being reported every day. We are seeing declines in the percent of tests that people are getting that are positive. And we know that the majority of our testing is still among people who are sick, who are have symptoms of some type that they are worried that they have, they or their provider believe they might have COVID disease. So that's a good sign that the percent positivity is going down. Our number of deaths in the last few days has decreased as well. We were, of course, did see an increase in deaths with this second wave. Again, still mostly in elderly, but that's that's not, shouldn't be cause for comfort for any of us. The younger set shouldn't be reassured by that. We know that serious illness has occurred in every age group, and we have seen deaths in people as young as in their 30s. Although, again, for sure, people in the older age groups are the most heavily hit. We do have a couple areas of the state that continue to cause us concern, in particular right now. Parts of eastern Idaho have seen increases where they really were spared in the first wave. They never really saw a lot of cases. So we're keeping a close eye on that, working closely with the district health departments and their boards who are working to try to see what they can implement to turn that around. The other area of concern I'm sure shared by everyone here on this panel is southwestern Idaho, in particular Washington and Payette counties have seen recent increases. Canyon County seems to be turning around. Case rates and numbers are coming down, but Washington and Payette County continue to give us concern. I'll just mention that despite this good news, as far as recent days, we're very also concerned. A couple things are going against us right now. One is we've got flu season coming up. I know we'll talk about flu throughout this hour, but we know flu season and other respiratory viruses start to trend up. So we're going to have more sick people to worry about, and to worry about that they may have COVID. We're going into fall season where people are going to stop playing outside as much. There'll be more indoor gatherings, more people crowded together potentially in indoor environments. And of course, with schools and universities opening up, we have, and I understand the desire to have in-person learning, but we're going to have more potential opportunities for spread that way. So I'll leave it at that. But a lot going on. We're hopeful, but also not complacent.
Thank you, Dr. Han. So shifting to our local health systems, I'll direct this question to both Dr. Burgess and to Dr. Souza. Can you tell us a bit about what the COVID situation is looking like currently in the hospital setting? Are we still in full-on crisis mode? Are we able to sort of balance the ongoing COVID response with bringing elective procedures back in? Are we having challenges with PPE supply like we were back in June? What are the challenges we're facing now? So I'll start with Dr. Burgess on that one.
Thank you. I think probably some similar story between myself and Dr. Souza. As Dr. Han mentioned, we are seeing some decline in cases recently. We did have a pretty big surge in the July timeframe. And what we saw then was a higher percentage of patients that needed ICU care. And that, as I'm sure everybody's familiar with and has read, is really the worry is preserving our ICU beds so that we have capacity to take care of people. And we are doing better now. That's declined a little bit. We still have some critical care patients, but not to the volume that we did in the July timeframe. We're cautiously waiting to see what happens after Labor Day, because it can take, up to 14 days to really see the impact of events like that. Like I'm sure St. Luke's is doing as well, we have resumed some elective procedures. We're very cautious about testing folks to make sure they don't have COVID so that they have a good recovery, and also having areas that are protected from COVID patients so that the vulnerable are not exposed to the sick. And that's been a lot of what we're working on right now.
Yeah, similar story at St. Luke's as what Dr. Burgess just described. The capacity for care right now is good, and to be clear, it's better than it has been. And to put some quantification around that, this is the first week in 10 weeks where we've been operating our adult beds and our ICU beds around 100% of predicted. But today specifically, we're at 110% of usual activity there. This is the first time in my professional experience that I've seen a spike in ICU activity last this long. So we were at 125 to 130% of usual activity for 10 weeks in a row. So this is the first week we've seen it come down. And frankly, I have concern sharing that message with this audience or any audience because of the danger of the mission accomplished conclusion that might be drawn. And I said this one other time, I'm going to say it again today, that the message should not be that we're winning. The message is that it's working. And now is the time to to keep up the focus. The virus is the same. It really hasn't changed. Our treatments haven't changed. We don't have herd immunity. We don't know when we're going to have an effective vaccine. So, and we know how it spreads. And as both Drs. Hahn and Burgess have already mentioned, the uncertainty that we're facing in the near-term future is the cold weather, schools, and more congregate indoor activity. And we don't know how that's going to impact what we see going forward.
So shifting to a bit of a policy discussion, in the early months of responding to the virus and rebound efforts, the governor was really in, and his task force were somewhat in the driver's seat with respect to the initial stay-at-home order and then the rebound stages. And then when we reached a certain point, that leadership shifted to local health or regional health boards. And so I would love to hear Commissioner Lauciano share a bit of what have been the strengths of that decentralized leadership approach and what have been some of the pitfalls of that approach.
So I think the shift to a local approach makes sense in one factor, and that is we are a very large geographic state, and what's happening here in Ada County is really not reflective at all of what's happening, for example, in Lewis County, North Central Idaho, population of about 3,500. Very different situations. So it doesn't necessarily make sense to have the same level of mitigation in both places, depending on what's happening on the ground. On the other hand, I think it's been somewhat confusing for our citizens. And especially here in the Treasure Valley, knowing that we have two different health districts that operate really right down the middle of the Treasure Valley. And just by way of history, those health districts, my understanding is, were really set up to ensure that some of our more rural counties had access to the same level of resources and expertise that our more urban counties had. But it doesn't necessarily lend itself well to a virus that, as I have been saying frequently, doesn't really care where the Canada Road is. So that has been challenging. It has been difficult for both our staff and certainly our board members at the health district. Some folks have heard me say that, the most controversial thing that we were dealing with as recently as December were septic system approvals. So we went from, maybe having one person show up at a board meeting to a lot of interest and scrutiny, and rightfully so, for what the board is doing. And then, finally, I would say sort of more logistically and practically for us, Ada County is the healthcare heartbeat for not only this valley, but really all of Southern Idaho. And so even as we are mitigating and reducing here in Ada County and doing what we can to slow the spread, to meet those overarching objectives, to protect the vulnerable and to not overwhelm the healthcare system, if activities are going on in our surrounding counties, it still impacts the ability to deliver healthcare here in Ada County, because there simply isn't that healthcare resource in some of our smaller communities. So that is of concern. And I'll just share with the group, I was on the receiving end of a phone call from Dr. Birx from the White House Coronavirus Task Force. And that was really what she was concerned about, was the potential for some of our rural counties combined with our urban center to really overwhelm our health system.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Lauciano. I'll take a quick pause to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to a City Club of Boise virtual conversation featuring Drs. Patrice Burgess, Christine Hahn, and James Souza, and Ada County Commissioner Diana Lauciano. So let's just shift briefly to a discussion of testing capacity. We know that at times that the turnaround times on testing have been very prolonged, and that the healthcare providers have had supply chain issues being able to access the supplies they need to run testing. Can you give us a state of testing since both, I'll start with Dr. Souza on this one, but Dr. Souza and Dr. Burgess, since you both serve on the testing task force, can you give us kind of the state of testing now?
Thank you. You know, I think testing capacity is better now than it was just a few weeks ago, largely because we've seen the number of requests for symptomatic tests come down. I know we have at St. Luke's, I know Primary Health Medical Group has seen that, and I believe St. Al's has too. You know, there's a lot of activity though happening in the states, in the health systems, between the health systems to collaborate to get ready for what the future might bring. You know, I alluded to the unknown of the cold weather, flu that was mentioned, and increased congregate activity in schools and whatnot that's going to occur indoors. So I think we're hoping for the best, but preparing for increased activity. With that in mind, you know, the state under Brock Anderson, who's been coordinating testing activities now at the state level, is pulling together regional kind of multilateral partnerships to increase testing capacity. Our health system has also acquired some increased testing capacity that'll come online roughly November timeframe. And even later today, I have a conversation with Dr. Burgess and Dr. Nemerson at St. Alphonsus about how we collaborate on allocating those increased resources. So there's some good news that capacity is increasing. And then I'll just mention, I don't think it's ready for prime time, but I think by end of September-ish, we're expecting increased availability of antigen tests, which I think will cause us to rethink some of our testing strategies. I'll maybe let others comment on that.
Dr. Burgess?
Yeah, I think as Jim has been mentioning, I just want to highlight that one of the good things about all of this, if you can ever have a good thing about a pandemic, is that our health systems are really collaborating. St. Luke's, St. Al's, Primary Health, Salts are all of us really looking at how we can best share resources and do the best for our communities. And that's been a wonderful thing. And I hope we can continue that, you know, even beyond. One thing about tests I did want to mention, in addition to what Dr. Souza said, is there's really a variety of tests, and you can get real technical real quick talking about these tests and even almost need lab experts to explain it. But just to simplify it, we have quick tests that are called point of care tests that you can get the results pretty quickly, but you have to really focus on the right population of people to test. And then we have tests that are done in-house, whether that's in our laboratory at St. Alphonsus, St. Luke's, the VA, the state lab, variety of places. And then you have send-out labs that have to be sent out to the national reference laboratories. And that's where we really got a bottleneck back in the July timeframe when we were testing anybody that wanted a test, but we were overwhelming our local supply and then trying to use the reference labs while everybody else around the country was doing the same thing. And that's when we saw those wait times nationally happen. So the good news is we've built up more local capacity. And as Dr. Souza mentioned, our demand has calmed down a little bit. And so we're doing pretty well. We're still planning. And this partnership that he mentioned through the state, I think is going to really open up capacity. And we'll be looking at not schools, but there are people that were in close proximity, factories, meat packing plants, call centers, long-term care facilities that really need some kind of a regular ability to test. And we'll be looking at all of that as well. So it's exciting that we're getting a better handle on it.
Great. So I'm going to go ahead and rotate in a couple of test related questions that have come in from our listeners today. The first is, what would be the ideal availability of tests in terms of numbers, that we should be testing. We heard early on in this about a percentage of the population we should be testing, and what would be ideal in terms of turnaround for results?
Maybe I'm going to start with the back half of that question first. I think the ideal turnaround time is as quickly as possible. The test turnaround times that are days, 3-4 days, like we've been experiencing with sendouts, and certainly when it got to be a week, that's just like it was back at the beginning of the pandemic. And really, from a clinical perspective, you ask yourself why you're even doing the test when it takes that long. The first half of the question, you know, how many tests do we need? That one's more complicated. The simple answer is, I think more than we have now and more ubiquitous access than we have now. I'm just going to emphasize a point I've continued to make since the beginning, though, that still isn't applied consistently. Every time we do a test, it should inform a decision. And even if it's not being ordered necessarily by a provider in order to make a diagnosis of someone's symptoms, so even if it was in an asymptomatic person who wants to know if their exposure has caused them to acquire the infection, doing the test needs to inform a decision. So, you know, what I mean by that is, like, it shouldn't just be a gee whiz, you know, burn through a resource that we know is a precious resource that we need. It should inform a different response, like, wow, I'm infected, therefore I'm actually going to self-quarantine. Or, no, I'm not infected, but phew, that was a close call. I'm actually going to stick to the 3 W's of, you know, wearing a mask and watching my distance and washing my hands in a way that I wasn't doing before. I've seen a fair bit of testing that's been done to sort of satisfy curiosity and then just kind of go back to, well, I'm good. I guess I'm good to go. So I'll truncate my comments there.
Yeah. So Dr. Burgess, maybe you could help. There's another question about exactly what is an antigen test. And I know the PCR tests were being used to diagnose whether you currently had the virus. How is an antigen test different from that? Dr. Souza mentioned that earlier.
Yeah, an antigen test is the actual material of the virus. And so you have to be pretty symptomatic in the high peak of your symptoms to have a positive antigen test. It's not the greatest screening test, and it's not going to be positive if you're really early in your infection or if you're really late in your infection. The PCR test tests actual genetic material of the virus, and so it's going to be more sensitive. It's going to pick up more people, but it also lingers, and it's still positive even when you might not be infectious any longer. So there are different tests run by different methods, and they have, as he very well described, you know, different impacts on your decision processes. The PCR would be the more sensitive, meaning it's going to pick up more people, but may or may not be infectious.
Great, thank you. I'm going to shift back to a policy-related question. You know, that this year with the public policy decisions that have been made along the way and the various public health orders, we have seen community members turn to maybe a tad more aggressive forms of protesting those decisions and airing their grievances about those decisions, but even going so far as to protest in front of elected officials' homes. And I know, Commissioner Lachiando, you had this happen to you. If citizens do have legitimate concerns about public policy decision-making, what might be a better avenue for them to express those and to know that they are being heard, given that it is a little more challenging when many of these meetings are virtual? But can you talk a little bit about those protests? What what impact that has had on you and other elected officials, and what's a better path?
Well, thank you. And, you know, I think this actually speaks not only to the situation we have with coronavirus, but also we've had a pretty raucous summer as it relates to social policy in general, and lots of thoughts and feelings and concerns and protests on a number of issues. So I guess I would first say that I want to offer a lot of empathy, because I recognize that people have faced job loss. They have faced food insecurity. They are, like me, juggling working while managing online schooling. And if you've heard me tell this, I am a terrible math teacher. So I want to recognize that 2020 has been, you know, quite frankly, terrible, and we're all ready for it to be over. And it has been very fraught and has probably exacerbated a lot of issues for many people. And as a democracy, we also have a right to hold our elected officials accountable and to speak to them and to engage them. And I guess I would say that, you know, what has been more effective in engaging with me, certainly I read every single email that gets sent to me through the Board of Health, and I have tried to incorporate many of the questions and concerns that have come up into my own questions as a part of our Board of Health meetings, so that people can hear in real time the thought processes. And in many ways, our discussions are much more accessible than they ever were, because we were not prior broadcasting on YouTube. You know, lastly, I think just, you know, more personally and really as a mom, I have two young kids, and I willingly signed up for this. I put myself out there. I put my name on the ballot. My kids didn't sign up for this. And, you know, it breaks my heart that they have had to, you know, be scared to sleep in our house for a few days because of the choices that I made as an elected official. And I guess I would just say that it really calls into question, you know, what do we want out of our democracy, and who do we want to run for positions? And if only people who live in gated communities where no one can enter feel safe running for office, that's going to be a problem for us as a society. So I think there are much more effective ways, on no matter what the issue is, to engage with elected officials. And I hope that people will take those avenues.
Thank you. And we did have a question come in about, you know, given the comment that you made earlier about the virus not respecting boundaries between health districts and that sort of thing, would it be your opinion that this decision making should remain decentralized at the regional health board level? Or do you think that there is a point that the governor should pull it back more into central management? What approach do you think would be better at this point?
You know, we had that scenario, right? This past spring, we had Wood River Valley get overwhelmed very quickly, and quickly had to, as Dr. Souza will tell you, shift patients up to Twin Falls because how quickly that health system was overwhelmed. So the governor did step in that situation because he recognized what a threat that was going to be, not only for that community, but really to our health system in Southern Idaho. And I think I have had conversations with the governor's office about this very same thing. What is the point when and if you do need to step in? I don't know what that looks like for him, but that is the concern that I have ongoing, because our health district has a limited footprint in terms of what we can control. And I also don't want our residents in Ada County to be the only ones sort of holding the bag, if you will, to make sure that we can maintain healthcare resources. And that's, I think, an ongoing conversation.
Yeah, thank you for that. I'm going to shift back to Dr. Hahn. You referred to the flu season coming on and that is a concern. Do you think that we will have perhaps a lighter flu season this year just because of the other precautions that we are taking with masking and distancing?
Yeah, Corey, can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Okay, great. I've been having some technical difficulties. I'm glad that I'm audible. Okay. Yeah, so that's a great, that's obviously the million-dollar question. There is some signs out of some of the Southern Hemisphere countries of perhaps a milder flu season going on in what is now their winter. I don't think we'll know for sure, but it'll be interesting to see, because if people are doing what we're asking them to do, Dr. Sousa mentioned the three W's, if people are doing that, if they're wearing masks and social distancing, staying home when they're sick and washing their hands, we should have a very mild flu season in theory, but we know that there are people that are not following all that, are not able to follow all those recommendations. It's one reason why we're urging people, even if they're not normally flu shot people, people that don't usually get the flu shot every year, to please help stop the spread of the flu by getting a flu shot this year. It's so important, not only because of what both Dr. Burgess and Dr. Sousa referred to keep the hospitals from being overwhelmed. If they start getting hit with a lot of flu patients in the hospital, we may run into a real crisis. So we don't know what the flu season is going to be like, but we're urging people to not only continue to follow what we're doing for COVID, because it all works for flu and other respiratory viruses, but also to get a flu shot. I've seen that they're already available around the communities, wherever you're, whether it's your doctor's office, whether it's a local pharmacy or urgent care clinic. Flu shots are available. There are, every year it seems like there's a couple new ones out there for people. If they've had troubles in the past, there are some new formulations. There are formulations designed for seniors. There are types for kids. Really, there should be something for everybody out there now, and we do urge you to, it's not too soon to get it.
Great. Thank you, Dr. Hahn. Mm. So I'm going to shift to the big question of the month, and that is about school reopening and sports resuming. Any sort of particular concerns you have with the direction we're taking right now? So Commissioner Lachiando, the Central District Health Board, has just kind of ramped down our level from red to yellow, which will allow some more hybrid type learning. I'll throw this out to any of you on the panel to just make any quick comments about concerns or maybe hopeful signs about school reopening and sports.
I'd be happy to start off. So just first to clarify, and it has been so confusing for folks to understand who's making decisions at what level. In the back to school framework outlined by the state of Idaho, it's the role of the health district to assess what level of community spread we're in, to publish that, and then the school board makes decisions based on that. And as you've seen, different school boards have taken different paths. So it's actually not a board level decision. It's our staff every week who review the data and then publish what the numbers are and what level we're in. And we're just so pleased that we are in yellow at this point. I've had many, many parents call me, talk to me. We've had some really engaging conversations. And I think the biggest thing that I can share with them is that I believe we can do this. I believe we can get our kids back to school in some form, but we also have to ask ourselves, what are we doing in the rest of our lives to make sure that we aren't promoting spread elsewhere? So if my priority is for my kids to be back in school, then I'm not hosting multifamily, multigenerational gatherings. I'm not, hosting a wedding with multiple people, we really have to keep our eyes on the prize if that is our goal. And I'm trying to make it real for people. My father unfortunately passed away in the beginning of August. And this is a man who, we would have packed the church, right? We would have packed it, and I'm Basque, and we would have had a rockin' Basque celebration. Unfortunately, we just could not do that right now. And I look forward to be able to doing that in 2021. So I think we can get our kids back to school, but we have to be diligent in the rest of our activities to make sure that that continues to be able to happen.
Thank you. Comments from others on school reopening?
I just want to make a comment. I think what she said is absolutely perfect. And then also the schools, you know, are getting a lot of advice, not just from the health district, but from medical professionals at, you know, distancing, masking, keeping surfaces clean, all of the different things that we know can be helpful. And so I think as we do this gradually and don't go from 0 to 60, but we really take our time and reassess, like anything we do, do something for a week or two, see how it's going, and then cautiously move forward. I agree that we can do this safely, but with all the precautions that she mentioned as well in the rest of our lives.
As the mother of a new high school senior, any prognostication from anyone about the likelihood of being back to having gatherings like proms and graduations by the end of this school year? Or is this likely to be a much more sustained situation going into next year? Maybe Dr. Hahn, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, as the mom of a high school junior and a junior high schooler, I'm with you guys at Boise Public Schools and eagerly waiting to see how this plays out. I would say as far as prognosticating, none of us, of course, are going to stake our reputations on anything but with firmness, because the truth is we don't know. None of us know. There's so many things at play. Obviously, how well do we do at keeping this virus in check and following all the recommendations we've been talking about? How well does our society do with that? How quickly does a vaccine become available? That's a whole other topic, and obviously very challenging to know right now. If we have a vaccine, and if people want the vaccine, do people have confidence that it's safe? Are people interested in receiving it? How much herd immunity do we really need, whether through natural infection or with added of some people being vaccinated? Where do we need before we start to see real herd immunity that's not entirely clear yet? So there's so many unknowns. I think none of us would be willing to guess. I am hopeful that by next spring, we start to see some, you know, if we have a vaccine come winter, come late fall, come winter, I'm hopeful we'll start to see some of those gatherings be okay again. But I'd say it's too early to tell.
Are we starting to see any data yet about immunity or reinfection of the virus?
Yeah, a couple things. One is that there have not been many case reports. Initially, we had a few out of Asia, and now there are a few out of the United States of apparent reinfection with this virus. So we've always been a little unsure with coronaviruses, this family of viruses, because we know that the seasonal coronaviruses, the ones that cause colds that circulate, we know that people get reinfected with those. So we've always had some doubt that immunity, while apparently robust, that it would be long lasting. The big question mark is going to be with the vaccine, if we can get a vaccine together that develops a long-term immunity, or if we start to see evidence that, yeah, you can get reinfected, but the second time around, you've got some immunity. You're not going to land in the hospital. You're not going to hopefully spread it as much. If we start to see evidence like that, that will help us a lot. Those vaccine trials, you're probably aware, there are three going on in the United States, although one of those three trials has just been halted, I heard this morning, because of a possible side effect in a patient in the United Kingdom. So we still have the other two trials still ongoing as of today. They're trying to enroll 30,000 people in these trials to see if we can get a safe and effective vaccine out there very quickly.
Great. So back to Commissioner Lacciando just briefly. So there was discussion recently with the Central District Health Board about, you know, once schools get reopened, then we can look at bars reopening. Do you feel comfortable that I know there were groups of bar owners that have gotten together and tried to put together some thoughtful plans about how to do that safely. Do you feel like we're in a good spot with respect to readiness for that to happen? Or is there anything in particular that those bar owners need help with?
Thanks, Corey. So I'll quote Director Duke, which, you know, if these bar owners and bars in general are very sincere about following the precautions and steps laid out, they will really look more, they will look and feel more like restaurants, which have been operating pretty successfully throughout the summer. And that's because of the precautions that they're taking, the social distancing, et cetera. You know, I'm not the epidemiologist on the panel, but I, you know, we'll just share, obviously we're concerned about close quarters, loud talking, loud music, you add in alcohol, and maybe inhibitions are lowered. And certainly what we saw with that spike the end of June really sort of lit the flame that landed us in kind of a world of hurt for the next couple months. So if they are following those precautions, I think we'll be okay if they're acting like restaurants. And I guess I would sort of add on to that, that the case clusters that are coming out that we're seeing right now are not in those public settings. They're not occurring at restaurants or at grocery stores or even at gyms. You know, we discussed that because of the White House report. We are seeing it from social gatherings. It's the baby shower, it's the wedding shower, it's the backyard barbecue. And I think the hard thing is that it is natural human behavior to let your guard down around people you know and around your family. So it is hard to think that you have to distance, you have to wear a mask, but that is just simply where we're seeing the cases come from and where we need to be even more diligent.
Thank you. I'll again take a brief pause to remind our radio listeners that you're listening to a City Club of Boise virtual conversation featuring Drs. Patrice Burgess, Christine Hahn, and James Souza, and Ada County Commissioner Diana Lachiando. So next, I'd like to shift back to a question for our hospital representatives about the pretty strict visitation restrictions that hospitals have had nationally that have been very difficult for patients and their loved ones. Can you, you know, help explain the importance of those restrictions and what in what situations visitors are allowed in your facilities? So I'll start with Dr. Souza.
Sure thing. Thank you. Yeah, the first thing to say about visitation is that our policies are evolving with our knowledge. You know, I know that we have, as we've understood better how transmission occurs and what safe behavior and non-safe behavior looks like, we've been able to relax restrictions to some degree. Particularly now that we have universal masking in place, right, as a policy, everybody's wearing a mask, and that we're able to maintain the physical distances that are required, we've liberalized visitation a bit. So, you know, we take care of really vulnerable populations of people, and the worst possible scenario would be an outbreak inside a healthcare facility that we could have prevented. And we know that the patients who are there who don't have COVID, if they acquire it because of their vulnerability, are more likely to become critically ill or to die. You know, we're comfortable that if you, knowing what we know about how it's transmitted, if you create plans that accommodate for that and you adhere to those plans, and that's what our visitor policies are about, you can conduct all kinds of healthcare, and all of our healthcare systems are doing that and they have been safely.
Thank you, Dr. Burgess.
Yeah, this is another area where we've been really collaborating and trying to be consistent so it's not confusing to the public. And just like Dr. Souza said, adapting as we learn more and trying to be reasonable Commissioner Lachiando said with the bars that it lit a fire, it would light a fire in a hospital if we had multiple exposures. Any additional visitors bringing wherever they were that day, maybe they were at the grocery store, maybe they were at a backyard barbecue, and it's just an exponential exposure. And those vulnerable folks, it would just take off like crazy, and we would feel horrible about that, as would everyone else. So it's one of the more painful things about COVID, I think, is I have two elderly parents in a long-term care facility that I haven't seen since June. We all have those stories, and the same thing for people in the hospital, but we're trying to accommodate. I know both systems are using iPads or FaceTime, other ways to have virtual visits, ways to communicate with families and help them feel involved in the care, and doing the very best we can. And then certainly making exceptions, as he mentioned, end of life, labor, and those types of things when we can safely do so. Everybody's screened that comes into the building at both of all the facilities, and universal masking as well. So we're doing everything we can to keep people safe.
Thank you very much. So I'd like to shift and talk a little bit about disparities that show up with respect to many different health conditions, but this COVID pandemic has really shined a light on differences in health outcomes and risk between different groups. So I'll open that up to any of you that would like to comment on how disparities show up with respect to COVID.
Well, I can get started. I look at our data every day in painful detail. And as I look at that, of course, I always look at our race and ethnicity data, which is, you know, one way we look at groups, of course. And we've been fortunate in that we haven't seen some of the differences by race in Idaho. Now, that said, of course, we have a vastly majority of white population, but we are fortunate to see proportionally no marked increase in some of those minority populations. However, in the Hispanic ethnicity, we do see more cases than we would expect by the percent of, they're about 12% of Idaho's population is Hispanic, and about 34% of our cases are among Hispanic population. We think some of that is due to, I think Dr. Burgess already referred to some of the crowded conditions we have in some of our food facilities, food workers, some of our other employment settings where we have had outbreaks have had a large percentage of Hispanic workers. And we also have observed the local health department investigators when they interview some of the Hispanic patients, they have more people in the household with spread into multiple generations sometimes in those settings. That said, I'm very relieved to see as we have moved forward, we have not seen a disproportionate number of deaths in the Hispanic population. That is about right at about 12-13% of our deaths have been in Hispanic individuals. So again, would prefer not to see any deaths at all, but that is somewhat reassuring. That said, I don't want to overlook, I already alluded to earlier, we know that older individuals are heavily hit, and particularly individuals living in assisted living, long-term care. We have had more cases and deaths in that population than we have among younger people per the size of the population. And that's a whole other topic, of course, but there's been a lot of work done to try to protect those individuals in the state. That's just an ongoing concern. I'll leave it at that and let others speak up of what they've seen.
I'm just going to confirm what Dr. Hahn said. Our internal data also points toward a concern with Latinos. Across our footprint, Latinos make up about 7% of the population of folks we care for, and they represent 27% of our hospitalizations and 32% of our ICU hospitalizations. So just confirming what she said.
I think the one other comment I would add, it's not really disparity along ethnicity, but medical conditions, you know, certainly elderly, but also we're seeing diabetes and obesity being two factors in the folks that have gotten really sick. And I think we've seen that across the country, that people have that have other illnesses, lung disease, smokers, and then diabetes and obesity are all at higher risk, and heart disease for being sicker with COVID if they get the disease.
Thank you. So I'm going to move to a discussion, some questions around mask, mask requirements, mask guidance. What is it about masks and asking people to wear masks that sparks such emotional resistance by some in the population? We seem to accept other laws and rules that require that we wear seat belts, we drive on the right side of the road, we wear shirts and shoes when we're out in public, we are expected to adhere to speed limits. Why is there such a gut reaction to an expectation or a request to wear masks? And how do we get past it?
Yeah, I'll start. I know we'll all each have our own thoughts on this. I think, first of all, if you go back, there was a lot of resistance to seatbelts. I'm sure this is way before my time, but I'm sure there were resistance to stop signs when automobiles first came out. I think we as a people, of course, we all love our liberties, and anything new is, you know, there's some people that are going to resist that. And just because we don't want to feel like more and more of our liberties are being taken away, no matter how minor it seems to be to others, you know, it's just one more thing. We don't like being told what to do, I think, as a people. I don't personally think there's anything in particular about masks compared to, you know, we all talk about the no shoes, no shirt, no service kind of signs that we've all gotten completely accustomed to. But I think there's a reason those signs are there, is that people used to wander into the store without a shirt and without shoes, and that was okay. None of us would dream of doing that now. So I'd like to hear others' thoughts, but I feel like it's a more of a general, we don't like new restrictions.
Thank you.
I was going to add to that. To follow on that, I think it is, you know, if you're kind of a student of history and study these things, there was resistance to drunk driving laws. I mean, there was, you know, a feeling that I should be able to, you know, have however many beers and drive my car. I think the additional challenge with the mask component is that it's truly a selfless act. We know that unless you're wearing an N95, which are prioritized for healthcare workers, you wear a mask to protect other people. And so it is a hard thing to, I think, wrap your mind around. And, you know, especially as Americans, we have a very kind of individual oriented society. And so I think that's the additional part that makes it difficult. And I mean, I'll just share, back in June, my kids were attending an outdoor day camp, and all of a sudden they were required to wear masks. And I was initially like, oh my gosh, this is going to be so hard. And how, you know, what, they're going to be hot. But they roll with it. And in many ways, they understand it better than some adults. You know, I'll hear them say, well, I'm wearing this so that my grandma doesn't get sick. So it is hard, it is cultural, and we're asking people to go from 0 to 60 through this whole process just really fast. And it feels like, I think, a lot of whiplash for people.
Thank you.
I would just add real quick, I liked what Commissioner Lanciando said about it. It was it's been a raucous summer, and it's been a raucous 2020. And I think this is just one more thing. It's kind of that pile on effect, that so many things have been taken away, and this just feels like one more thing. And who knows, maybe 6 months, a year from now, we'll all be very accustomed to wearing masks, just like we are wearing seatbelts. And like many other countries are during the winter, accustomed to wearing masks. We'll see.
Thank you. I'm going to shift now to a little more follow-up on vaccines. So, you know, when we look at vaccines as a potential path out of this, but yet a lot of urgency to get a vaccine out the door and distributed to people. Once vaccines become available, how confident can the public feel that they are safe, that the proper measures have been taken to make sure that they can feel safe doing that without undue risk?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I'll just say a couple things on that. First of all, you know, the nine vaccine manufacturers came together and wrote a letter really to the public, I think, assuring them that they would not seek rapid review and approval by FDA. They were going to go through all the normal channels like they would for any other vaccine. And, you know, eight of these manufacturers have a long track record. We're talking Pfizer and some of those companies that are not going to, they do not want to go down in flames with a bad vaccine. So I think we have a lot of work to do. Obviously, the studies are still ongoing. So I don't think any of us are going to get ahead of that message and start assuring the public now that we know it's safe, because we don't even know yet which vaccine is going to make it, which ones are going to be out there. But we are going to be watching that closely. I speak for the healthcare community. We're going to watch it closely. I'm actually a member of that advisory committee for immunization practices, a non-voting member, but I participate in all their meetings and can give comments to those meetings. They're rigorous. They're super informed. They're giving advice to the CDC on when vaccines come out, which ones are going to be safe and effective, and what are the recommendations, what are the populations to get them. It's a lot of work. I think there's going to be a lot of work in getting confidence, not just in the public, but really getting healthcare workers to feel comfortable with this vaccine or vaccines as they come out. It's going to be a lot of work, and I think nobody wants to try to railroad this. We all want the public to be confident in it. Otherwise, they will refuse it. It's not going to be a mandate. It's going to be voluntary. We are going to try to convince the public that this is the best thing for them. I don't know how, I'll ask Dr. Burgess and Susan to comment. I don't know if there's been any talk at the facilities yet. I don't know if there's any talk about healthcare workers are very likely going to be first in line. And really the first work is going to be making sure that healthcare workers feel comfortable with this vaccine.
Yeah, we're starting our internal dialogue about, you know, if and when a vaccine comes for, not if, when a vaccine comes forward, in which populations would it be required, assuming that there will be distribution challenges and potentially limitations, in which populations would it be allowed? So who are we going to prioritize? And, you know, I would only add to Dr. Hahn's comments, I was encouraged by the news today from AstraZeneca, because it suggests that their actions are following the commitments they made in writing and their words, because to pause with the sort of potential adverse reaction that they need to look into and understand whether that might be related to the vaccine or is completely unrelated, that's exactly what should occur with new vaccine science. So I was pleased to see that we're following that process.
So I'd like all of our listeners to please join me in silently from afar thanking our panelists, Drs. Patrice Burgess, Dr. James Souza, and Dr. Christine Hahn, and Ada County Commissioner Diana Lacciando for participating in today's discussion. Thank you all so much for participating, and we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Thank you.
This broadcast of the City Club of Boise was made possible with help from the Idaho Statesman, Idaho Public Television, 670 KBOI, and Boise State Public Radio. The premier sponsor is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU College of Business. The annual sponsor is St. Luke's Health System. The City Club is a nonpartisan forum with the motto, "Things happen when people start talking." The third annual Maryland Schuler Human Rights Forum is on Wednesday, September 23rd, featuring Pulitzer Prize-winning author and Idaho native Dr. Laurel Thatcher Ulrich. Register for that forum and learn more about the City Club at cityclubofboise.org.